Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 132. Finally, we're pivoting back into the story of Fidel Castro. The next several episodes cover his life and his ascendancy through the Cuban Revolution. We'll keep the wanders to a minimum now for the next several episodes. I know you probably think I'm getting pretty distracted with them lately. My apologies for that, as always. It's all part of the package deal here. You know, when you pick this box of chocolates. Before we tell the story of Castro himself, I want to say something about this man. You know, I pride myself on trying to be objective when presenting the evidence and facts to the listeners of this podcast. To avoid making conclusions where they are not obvious or really necessary to process the information. Not always am I perfect in withholding judgment, but I do stay conscious of my own rule here. I will continue to do the best that we can to present the history and the facts, but you have to understand that I am personally biased. This man Castro is a very bad man. Whatever humanitarian aims he might have had as part of the Cuban Revolution, they were completely overtaken by the brutality, the forcefulness, and the complete domination that he expressed over the entirety of the Cuban people once he acceded to power. And on top of that, it might simply be said that in the end, he committed the most common of sins that come in a revolution. He was simply one dictator replacing another. Ideology is one thing, and ideology often hides more of the real truth of the matter. In Castro's case, there was ample evidence of ordinary human and very personal greed. Some might say he was extraordinary in his own way. How could he have pulled off the steal of the century without being so? Others would say that he was just a garden-variety radical in possession of certain persuasive qualities who got very lucky under the circumstances of that day, and whose true colors and true personal avarice would eventually be revealed once he took the mantle. Of course, the truth is always more complex than just this. But in reading about this man, as is the case with so many that achieve something significant, probably all of these statements are quite true. But again, they all sum up to make up a very bad man. In getting ready for this series of episodes, I read many good books on the topic. One of those books included Castro's own spoken autobiography. You will hear material directly from that book in this episode. But one of the other books I found far more fascinating is a short book entitled The Double Life of Fidel Castro. It was written by Juan Reynaldo Sanchez, who remained as Fidel's bodyguard for 17 years before escaping from Cuba and eventually making his way to the United States. He gave a very detailed account of his time by Castro's side as one of his chief security agents. It truly is a fascinating read, and I believe it's a credible account. It's written with Axel Gildon as a co-author, and so its prose and readability are stellar. After attempting to retire in his mid-40s, that is during the 1990s, and after his daughter and sister had recently fled the country of Cuba, Sanchez was summarily removed from his intimate position as Castro's principal security officer, and he ended up spending 2 years in a Cuban jail on charges of being a traitor. That's what he got for wanting to leave. I'm sure the Cuban government would say more here. A typical moment for the propaganda machine to kick in. Sanchez would spend the next 12 years attempting unsuccessfully some 10 times to leave the country of Cuba. Finally, in 2008, that occurred. He escaped in a daring human smuggle, reuniting with parts of his family, and he spent the last 7 years of his life in Miami until he passed away in 2015. His book tells the story in what appears to be a relatively objective way. It feels that way to me. Like anyone in his shoes, anyone that would be in a position to write such a book of this nature, well, he got to where he was because of his unrequieted and unopposed view of the revolution. But over time, that view would dim, especially in light of the Ochoa affair and what he knew about it. That's a story we'll tell in a brief wander later before we pivot away from Cuba, and it's an event, that is the Ochoa affair, that says a lot about Castro's regime and Castro's personal ruthlessness, even to those loyal to him. Many years ago, Forbes published an article which estimated Castro's net worth at some $900 million. However crude the estimation techniques were in developing his net worth, the actual dollar value is somewhat irrelevant. It was a criminal amount of money, whatever amount it was. The absurdity of this man presenting himself as the leader of a communist-slash-Marxist revolution, earning 900 pesos in each paycheck, and sharing equally in the social spoils of a society, is a complete fabrication, and it's part of the web of disinformation that permeated Castro's dictatorial regime. It is nothing less than a clever obfuscation, the idea that he lived a simple and humble life as any other proletariat on the island would. That is a total lie. In fact, he lived quite a privileged life after the revolution, and I am speaking nothing about his acts of state here, the surveillance, the torture, and the killings that came after he achieved control of the island. All of that is separate and above and beyond. The fact is, he plundered the country in ways that I believe made some of the earlier corruption in earlier political regimes in Cuba look like a warm-up. For starters, he owned more than 20 houses on the island, including a complete, secluded, and majestic island with a home on it. At the end of this episode, as a bonus, we'll recite very specifically some of the information about some of those properties. The story that Sanchez tells is richly detailed, and it's indirectly relevant to the JFK assassination as well. He doesn't mention anything about the JFK assassination itself, and for the most part, that relates to timing. His tenure came long after the 1960s. In fact, it started around 1977. By that time, Castro was firmly entrenched, and the communist state apparatus had been firmly established in Cuba. And in so many ways, it was already a well-oiled machine. If nothing else, the intimate story that Sanchez tells validates the lifestyle that the Cuban leader enjoyed and details of his rather bizarre personal relationships and interactions with much of his family and with political figures on a daily basis. It also highlights the security apparatus that developed in Cuba as Castro emerged as its leader, much of it having been built upon the principles brought to them by the Soviets and the East Germans. And, of course, it was actually constructed with their help and assistance. As a lieutenant colonel and also in the position that he occupied, Sanchez was exposed to much of the country's security apparatus capabilities and techniques, and when reading the book, one cannot hesitate to believe that if such capabilities had reached any level of maturity by 1963, well, if so, then they easily and conceivably could have played into counterinsurgency mechanisms sophisticated enough to carry out an assassination of the President of the United States, and do it in a way that lacked any direct connection to the Cuban government at the time, and particularly any connection to Fidel Castro himself. Whether that conspiracy theory has legs, well, I have to leave that topic for later episodes. But I am 100% convinced that the mentality of this regime was completely capable of assassinating JFK, and more importantly, they likely had the means to do so. It really makes me chuckle at the naive conversation that Robert Blakey had with Castro when he went to Cuba and asked Castro, point blank, face to face, if he had any involvement in the JFK assassination. How absurd a question to ask Castro. Castro certainly had the motive with more than 24 plots identified by Cuban officials that were real in their assessment and that were, in their assertion, conjured up by the CIA to kill Castro once he came to power. Years after, the Church Committee was unable to verify that original list of 24 plots, which, by the way, was actually provided by the Cuban government to American officials and referenced by Fidel Castro himself. The Church Committee did, however, identify a large number of assassination attempts by the CIA, and later we will talk about those in more detail as well. All of this led to Lyndon Johnson's famous quote about the Kennedy assassination. He would say that Kennedy was running a damn murder inc. in the Caribbean, and that Kennedy was trying to kill Castro, but Castro got him first. Perhaps one of the more revealing statements in Sanchez's book is that Castro taped everything. Almost every formal and informal state conversation was taped, and it remains, as far as we know today, still extant, at least at the time Sanchez wrote the book before his death. Existing and in a highly guarded library with instructions for it to have been destroyed under certain circumstances. Of course, the first question that came to mind for me would have been the recordings related to the JFK assassination. Were they simply discussions on the periphery as mere observers? Surely some of those exist. Or would they reveal something more? Would they reveal involvement by the Cubans and the Cuban government? This is a very real question. Castro died in 2016, just a year after Sanchez did. And the whereabouts and contents and preservation of all of those tapes should have been a high priority for the world, particularly for the United States, because aside from just the JFK event, their contents would likely have been quite revealing historically on a plethora of the most meaningful events that have occurred in the last 75 years, primarily in the Western Hemisphere, but perhaps around the world. Oh, and there is that Russian connection as well. And one more thing. Reading the approach that the Cuban security apparatus deployed to protecting Fidel, Fidel's fanaticism about that protection, the attention to detail that was baked into his everyday life related to that security, well, it's no surprise that he lived to the ripe old age of 90, and our beloved JFK died at just about half of Castro's age, from a gunshot wound to the head. Our poor Secret Service at the time could have learned more than a thing or two about presidential protection methods. And had the CIA really understood the extent of the security apparatus around Castro, assuming it had already been brought to some level of maturity by 1960, they likely would not have spent a minute trying to undertake some of the harebrained schemes that were concocted to try and get to him. For they would have known that the security ring was so tight that the odds of that working were stacked against them. Of course, the idea that it was as mature in 1960 as described in Sanchez's book in terms of how it was in the 70s is conjecture on my part. And perhaps it yet wasn't, because it was very early on in Castro's pivot to power. But indeed, that is exactly how it turned out. It was a swing and a miss every time, even with the mafia involved with the CIA. Even with those two together, it was still a swing and a miss. We might be getting ahead of ourselves, as we inevitably do. So let's slow things down and go back to the objective of this episode, and that is to simply tell the story of Fidel Castro. Today is the first leg of that journey about this man, Fidel. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 132 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Thank you. Fidel Alejandro Castro Ruz was 26 years old the year that Batista commandeered control of the Cuban government in the coup of 1952. After the revolution that Castro incited, Cubans would come to know three new and distinct national holidays related to it. Fidel's birthday of August 13th would be one of those three nationally recognized holiday dates related to the struggle. That date, along with January 1, the date of the fall of the Batista government in 1959, and of course July 26th, the date of the failed raid at the Moncada installation. Those three dates make up the three national holidays in Cuba after the revolution. Two of these three dates are history in the making, and you'll hear the story of them as part of this series. Fidel Castro himself was the son of a wealthy Spanish farmer. He was born out of wedlock at his father's farm in the town of Barán, which is located in the Oriente province of Cuba. His father, Angel Castro y Arguiz, was a veteran of the Spanish-American War. His father had started out as a migrant who had emigrated to Cuba from Galicia, which is an area located in the northwestern part of Spain. Castro's father predictably got into the sugar cane growing business and developed a modest amount of wealth through his association with the Las Manacas farm in Barán. But after the collapse of his first marriage, he took to his household servant, Lina Ruz Gonzalez, whose ancestors were from the Canary Islands, and she became his mistress, and she would later become his wife. They would have seven children together, and among them was Fidel. At age six, Fidel was sent to live with his teacher in Santiago de Cuba, which is located on the extreme eastern side of the island. Like most of the population of Spanish descent, he was raised as a Roman Catholic. He would receive communion in the Roman Catholic Church at the age of eight. Being baptized enabled Castro to attend the La Salle boarding school in Santiago. He was known to be a handful at La Salle, and he was said to have regularly misbehaved. That was only his first stop at Catholic school. Next, he would be sent to the privately funded Jesuit-run Dolores School in Santiago. After that, he would attend the Jesuit-run El Colegio de Belén in Havana. Overall, Castro himself was afforded access to a solid academic education and privileges not afforded many in Cuba at the time. His next stop would be the University of Havana, which he entered in 1945 at the end of World War II. This is an interesting time in Castro's life, and it's time to let him tell it to us in his own words, words taken directly from his spoken autobiography, the period where he awakens politically and begins to ascend in Cuban activism and Cuban politics. I think it's safe to hear this part of Castro's story in his own words. There is not much to twist that changes the trajectory of the facts here. So here we go, in Castro's own words, about that period of his life, pieced together from various snippets in the book. I entered the university on September 4th, 1945. As a son of a landowner, I was able to finish the sixth grade, and then having passed the exams for the seventh grade, and after that I was able to enter prep school. Finally, I would be accepted at the University of Havana. I arrived with only a spirit of rebelliousness and some elementary ideas about justice, and there I became a revolutionary. I became a Marxist-Leninist, and I acquired sentiments and values which I still hold today, and for which I have struggled throughout my life. When I got to the university, I was a political illiterate. The university, as I've said, was dominated by a group that was closely tied to the government of Grau San Martin. From the moment I entered that first year, I could see an atmosphere of force, of fear, of weapons. There was a university policy totally controlled by groups linked to the power establishment of the moment. It was a bulwark in the hands of a corrupt government. The main leaders at the university also had positions, posts, privileges, and every governmental resource. And during the same period, the Shabazz Rebellion against the Auténticos took place, which would result in the founding of the Cuban People's Party, the Orthodoxy Party, When I got to the university, that incipient movement already existed. I began to react against so many things like those we were seeing. What I had was a rebellious spirit, hungry for ideas and knowledge, filled with curiosity and energy. Because from all the experiences I've lived through, I sensed from a very young age that there was a great many things to do in my life. In a relatively short time on my own and with very little knowledge of economics or other essential subjects, I started becoming what today I would call a utopian communist. And I did it on the basis of life experience, those first understandings I acquired of the traditional political economy that occurs in a capitalist society. I got a little of that subject, but very badly taught and very elementary in my last year of high school. And if I tell you that I became a revolutionary at the university, it's because I came in contact with certain books during the period. But before I read any of those books, I was already questioning the political economy of capitalism because even then, at such an early stage of my education, it seemed to me very irrational. In the very first year of my studies, there was a very demanding professor of political economy. His name was Portella. There was no textbook from a publisher, just a stack of 900 mimeograph pages. He was a terror. And I was lucky, though, because he gave an oral examination. I answered without any problems at all, and I got a surprisingly high grade. And this was a class that explained the laws of capitalism, but hardly talked at all about the various other economic theories. As I studied the political economy of capitalism, I began to have serious doubts. I began to increasingly question the system because I'd lived on a large estate, and I remember things and had dreamed about the solutions like so many other utopians in the world. I was a dreadful, terrible example as a student because I never went to class. In high school, as I told you, I never attended a lesson. Since I had to be in the classroom and I was a boarding student after all, I just let my imagination fly during the lesson and then just study at the end of the term, just before the exams. At the university, I never went to class either. What I did do was talk to the other students in the park and in the patio. There were always several students sitting around listening while I explained my theories. What I wouldn't give today to remember the actual arguments that I used to try to persuade on them and what I was trying to persuade them of. It was only in the last stage of my time there that I dedicated myself to really studying, and I had three majors: law, diplomatic law, and social sciences. Anybody who was going for 3 degrees had access to a scholarship. By then, my political ideas were very well defined, but I wanted to go deeper and increase my knowledge of economics, and I was thinking about a fellowship that would allow me to study in Europe or even in the United States. When I decided to really buckle down and study, I would study 15 or 16 hours a day. I'd have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with a book in front of me, never taking my eyes off what I was reading. When I arrived at the university, the number of people on the left, by the way, was minimal, just a tiny number. After the war and with McCarthyism and anti-communism all the rage, there was no more than 50 active known anti-imperialists. Back then, there was only very few students from the working classes or the countryside at the university. And really, other political and ethical subjects occupied the young people's attention, but not exactly the subject of radically changing society. The leftists saw me as a queer duck. They'd say, son of a landowner and a graduate of the College of the Belen? This guy must be the most reactionary person in the world. During the first few days, as I had in high school, I devoted a lot of time with sports, but after the first few weeks of that first year, I started to also take an interest in politics. And I took my first steps in that direction until within 2 or 3 months, I'd completely forgotten about basketball, baseball, football, and all the rest. I dedicated my life entirely to politics. I was a candidate for representative of my class, and I was elected, 181 votes to favor, 33 against. So I dedicated more and more of my time to that. As the election for the president of the FU the University Student Federation, drew near, I started to strongly oppose the government's candidate. That translated into countless dangers for me because it ran counter to the interests of the mafia that I told you dominated the university. The physical threats and pressures were enormous. When the FU elections were almost upon us, I was in the second year of law school. This mafia, irritated by my insubordination, decided after several incidents to use stronger methods of intimidation. They forbid and they forbade me to enter the university. I couldn't enter any university facilities. So what did I do? Well, I cried. That's right. I went off to a beach. I went off to a beach to meditate. And at the ripe old age of 20, I lay face down on the sand and cried. Tears welled up in my eyes. The problem was extremely complex. I was up against all the powers and all the impurities. They were armed, and they had no scruples about killing. They had the support of all the police agencies and Grau's corrupt administration. The only thing that had contained them had been a moral force. A moral force consisting of the growing mass of students who supported me. No one had faced them openly in their feudal empire at the university, and they weren't going to tolerate any more defiance, any more challenges to their authority. They also had the university police on their side. I ran the real risk of being killed in what would be alleged to be intergroup rivalry. I cried, but I decided to go back ready to fight, although I was aware that it might mean my death. A friend of mine got me a gun, a Browning 15-shot pistol, similar to the one that I use today. I was determined to go down fighting and not to accept the dishonor of not being at the university. And so began my first very idiosyncratic armed struggle against the government and the powers of the state. But that struggle wasn't characterized by the use of weapons. Instead, it translated into a series of incredible risks and acts of defiance. There were very few times I could carry a gun like that day. I ran the risk of being arrested by the police and subjected to an emergency trial. They were fast, and there was no bail. With that procedure, the enemy could easily take me out of circulation. So that became, perhaps, one of the hardest and most dangerous stages of my life. I went back to the university that day with five young men who spontaneously, out of sheer admiration for my solitary struggle, volunteered to go with me, all armed just like me. That action paralyzed those who had forbidden me to enter the university, but I couldn't get away with it forever. I remained unarmed, and the only exceptions being when I joined the expedition against Trujillo, and when I took part in the popular uprising in Bogota. The great battle for the National FU was resolved, miraculously enough, without casualties, but the risks that I ran, as I said, were considerable. That was the way the university I entered in 1945 was. Some of the 20-odd properties owned by Castro, as cited by Sanchez in his book, are as follows. These are, of course, in addition to what was unfettered access to countless state homes operated by the various government departments in Cuba and located around the island, and which were available to Fidel at any time. All his life, Fidel would maintain that he owned no properties other than a modest fisherman's hut. First, let's start with Calle Piedra. Calle, or K, translates to key in English. Think of the Florida Keys when you think K. This little island is a Caribbean jewel, and it was all Castro's. He found this secluded island, which is located about 10 miles off the coast of southern mainland Cuba, through the eyes of a local scout that took him on a tour of the Bay of Pigs area after the Bay of Pigs battle. So I guess you could say that the CIA indirectly contributed to its discovery by Fidel. It's over a mile long, stretching north to south, curved in shape, and now with a modest home on it and servants' quarters. It is undoubtedly a piece of paradise on the island itself and in the waters surrounding it. And it is surrounded by perhaps some of the most fantastic underwater ecology and diving sites in the Caribbean. And Castro was an avid and very capable diver. A man who could free dive to depths of more than 30 feet. This was a veritable private paradise, perhaps the equivalent of owning a part of the Bahamas or the Keys. When the island was split into two pieces by a hurricane, Castro would have a 700-foot bridge constructed to reattach the two island plots. On the fine sand beaches of the island, there would be built docking structures that could receive the Aquarama II, his yacht. He even had a dolphinarium there containing two tame dolphins that were always up for a prank or a jump. There would be a helicopter on standby to take him back whenever needed to Havana for official business. It is said that, at least at one point, you could actually see Cayo Piedra on Google Earth. Some of the other properties that Castro owned were Puntachero, which was his huge property in Havana near the embassy. And he also owned La Salita del Rosario, which also houses his private marina in the Bay of Pigs. And then there was La Decida, a chalet in the middle of a swampy area in the Pinar del Rio province, where Fidel went fishing and duck hunting every winter. It goes on and on. All I can say is that who needs capitalism when you are Fidel? It's good to be the king, or the dictator, or whatever it is you are, or were. Thank you for listening to episode 132 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.